This is Mary Ingleby interviewing Fred Davenport on the 10th of April 2013. So if we just start perhaps by you just introducing yourself to me.
Well, yes, I was born in Peckham in London in 1921, and then we moved out to Essex and when I was four, and I spent most of my young life and teenage years in Ilford. And at the outbreak of war, I then joined the Royal Navy. So I was hoping to join the Army because my family were Army, but one of my school chums who was in the Navy said, "Why don't you join the Navy, Fred?" And I said, "Well, as a Cockney kid living in London, what the hell could I do in the Navy?" And so he said, "Well, we've got all sorts in the Navy, every trade, and everybody is a sailor first and then their trade later," because I was in an accounts clerk then, and so there was an exam for the supply branch, or the accountant branch as it was in the Navy then, and I took the exam and passed and joined the Navy in January 1941. And I joined for 7 years with the fleet and 5 with the reserve. And come the end of the war, I thought that perhaps it was going to be the same as after the Second World War, that there would be no jobs, no heroes, because when I went back to my firm, they did say, "Well, you've been away 6 years." And so I decided to stay in the Navy. And I took the exams for promotion, and after a few years, I managed to become a naval officer. And so I then carried on, and I stayed in the Navy for just over 30 years and ended up as a lieutenant commander.
Thank you. So just going back to the beginning of when you first went into the Navy, enlisted in the Navy. So what rank do you go into?
I was just a probationary writer then, just the lowest of the low. You join as, and then you gradually come up to able seaman rate, and then leading hand, which is corporal, then petty officer, then chief petty officer. And then, in my days, you became a warrant officer if you passed the exams, which I did. And then in 1956, they decided that instead of having two officers' messes on a ship, the warrant officers and the wardroom, they would make all warrant officers up to sub-lieutenants and whatever, and we all became one wardroom. Instead of having, as you say, when you became a warrant officer, your chances of getting farther were a bit remote. But now it's opened up, and I know that there are lots of people who come from lower deck who end up as captains, admirals now. So things have progressed.
Yeah, it's a good thing, isn't it? It's pulled out. So, but you were talking about your friend had said you're a sailor first and then you do your trade second.
Yes.
So what did they ask you what trade you wanted to do?
Well, no, because if you go in those days, there was an examination for I think it was called the accountancy branch of the Navy, and they held it in all the port divisions, Portsmouth, Chatham, Scotland and Devonport, and I took the exam in Portsmouth. It was a 2-day exam, and I came down to Portsmouth and took the exam, and naturally you ask a lot of questions, and there were people who'd taken the exam before, and I asked, how many they passed, and I was told it was about 50, which would have been about 25 writers and 25 stores accountants. And I said, "Oh, well, that's not bad," because, there looked as though there were about 200 or 300 sitting in Portsmouth in the drill shed. But I was then told that that was only one. There were 5 or 6 examination centres all over the country.
And that was out of all of them?
And so that the meant there were probably about 1,000 or at least. And I took the exam on the first day, and the first one was maths, actually. And I had about 10 minutes to spare at the end. And I looked at my paper just to check it. And on the top of the question paper, it was candidates must write on one side of the paper only. And I'd written on both sides, and so I thought, well, that's my... And I told my father, and that I said, well, he said, well, perhaps you must take it again. I said, I don't know whether there'll be another exam, Dad, because the war started. And strangely enough, I passed. And so my father's rejoinder to that was, you either must have done a good paper, or the one who marked your paper was just as blind as you and didn't see. And so I was then... I had to wait then. I told my mother, I said, well, if I've passed, Mum, there'll be a small envelope which tells me where to report. If I don't pass, then they'll send all my certificates and papers and everything back. And it was just before Christmas in 40, and my mother got, and it was a small envelope. And I never knew until many years afterwards, my mother said that, stared at me all day. She knew that I was leaving home. And then in January, I joined to do my training at Chatham. And then you did your seamanship training, and then you did your professional training afterwards.
How long did that take then,
the training? That took about... from January till about June, about 5 months, 5 or 6 months. And then I came down to Portsmouth, because I nominated Portsmouth to be my Portsmouth division. And within a few days of being there, I got my draft jet to the Eagle. And I joined the Eagle out of Freetown after... joining a Donata Castle, which was an armed merchant cruiser. And I took passage on there and joined the Eagle in Freetown. That was in July 41.
So, I mean, obviously you were a young man, and as you say, you know, when you're a young man, you just think, you don't really think of consequences of things.
No,
you just go for it.
Don't. Well,
but, I mean, what was your... Can you remember... You must have been very pleased that you passed. It must have been exciting.
Oh, yes, I was. I was, because, you know, I wasn't quite 18 when the war started. And I went and... it was one of my school chums, and he was over 18, to join the Royal Artillery. I was told to come back when I was aged and shaved, and so... That was when I was a bit disappointed, because Alan had joined and I wasn't. And so that was when one of my chums, who was already in the Navy as an artificer apprentice, said, why don't you join the Navy for it? And that's how it all started.
So had you done any travelling at all before?
No, never been out of the country before at all, no. Well, we didn't in those days. I mean, you know, lived in Essex, I think... You went to places like Clacton, Southend, Great Yarmouth, and that was it. I mean, when you think now today, the world is an open oyster, isn't it? Everybody travels now.
Yeah, all over the place. So you went off to Freetown. You told you were going to get you were going to be on the HMS Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know about the HMS Eagle? Did you know anything about the ship?
Well, not at the time, I don't think you did. It was just an aircraft carrier to me, but it was one of the oldest aircraft carriers in the Navy, in fact, one of the first. So, when we were in the South Atlantic and the Atlantic, and also when afterwards we came home in 1941 to Liverpool for a refit, and then we left there just early 42 to go to Gibraltar to join the Force H, which was operating between Gibraltar and Malta, because the Ark Royal had been sunk then, and so we replaced the Ark Royal. And so the fact that the ship was so ancient, and that I don't think it really got to me. It was just another ship.
I mean, you can totally understand your mother just thinking, there's my boy in the middle of all this.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't realise until you get older how much it must affect them. The fact that there was a war on, I was at sea, and I only had one brother then. I had two brothers. One died when he was 3 years old, and I was six, and then I had another brother who was then 8 years younger than me. And so he was the only one at home, you know.
Yeah, it must have been hard, and hearing, at least they didn't get the media coverage that we get today,
I mean, the point was they didn't know where you were, so they didn't have it sort of rammed down their throats. That's why I always think today with people who are in Afghanistan, it must be very sort of hard to take for people at home.
Yeah.
But then that's the media, isn't it? The media loves it.
Mm. Absolutely. So let's talk about, you start your work on HMS Eagle. So what is your actual job on the ship?
Well, when I joined the ship, I joined the ship in the pay office, and I was a second hand to a chief writer. And then that was because you kept all the people's pay accounts and you paid them, paid the sailors. And then after we went to Gibraltar in 42, I passed for leading hand, which meant I became a leading hand, a leading writer then. And then I was transferred into the captain's office and I became the assistant to the captain's secretary, and that's the job I was doing when the ship was sunk.
So when you say that you paid, were all the sailors paid in cash?
Yes.
So you must have had a huge amount of cash on board.
Well, yeah, they always had money on board. Yeah. But and of course that went down when the ship was. Yeah. But no, the thing was that sailors then in those days were paid in. You know, that there was paper rate. You sat, and as the chap come up, he called him, you ticked him off, called out how much he had, and put it on his cap, and that was it. Or the officer put it on his cap. You just mentioned who he was.
And you must have been quite popular, because people like coming to get paid, don't they?
Well, I suppose so. You could say you were popular, but then on the other hand, of course, If there were occasions when perhaps chaps' pay had to be docked or something, then you weren't very popular.
No. That's true. So tell me about the second job then, when you were working. So you were working for the captain's secretary.
Secretary, yes.
And what did that involve then?
Well, that involved all the correspondence that came to the ship, the signals, and punishment warrants, and looking after the all the ship's company's service certificates, which had all their history on board during their career, and that when anything happened, you had to note it on there.
So it's a sort of more of an administrator than an accountant
job.
Yes,
yeah, that's right. Mm.
And was it? I mean, just to get a sort of picture of what the ship was like. I mean, whereabouts in the ship were you working all the time? What level?
Well, at the pay office was right can't think where it was now, I'm trying to think where it was. And it was right on the difficult to remember when after all these years, but it was down aft, and in fact it was in the area where one of the torpedoes hit.
How many decks were there, roughly?
I can't remember now.
How many people, approximately, how many sailors were on board a ship that size?
Well, there were just over 1,000, but I think we lost about 180 or something. I've got a figure down there I could read to you.
We'll do it afterwards. Mm. That's fine. Mm. Thank you. Because I was just trying to get a sort of picture of the ship and thinking of you, where you were working, but also wondering about how often you got. So if you were working, did you work a sort of office hours day?
Well, yeah, you did sometimes, but then if there was more work to do, you just worked until you finished, you know. I mean, there was nothing like an office where you went in at 9 o'clock and then went for lunch and then packed up at 6 o'clock if there was work to be done. And there was quite a lot of work to be done, then you carried on doing it. I mean, there were some times when you were trying to, because you remember there were no calculators in those days, so you had to do it all. And there were times when you were trying to prove your ledgers, particularly at the end of each quarter, where it would take hours, and so there was times when you were working well into the night just to get it, because you had to do it, and then at the end of each quarter all those ledgers were sent off to the Admiralty, and that's how they compiled all their records in the Admiralty from the ledgers.
Of course, that was really important. Mm. to balance the books. Mm. And did you get to go then? I mean, I was just sort of get to go on deck and work out where you were.
Oh, yes,
and
yeah,
all
you
that.
Did.
Yeah.
I mean, you had your sort of periods where you were, and you went on deck, and sometimes you, depends what you did, sometimes you perhaps read a book and so, and or else there was once a couple of times when we had a little group of us used to go on the Spronson decks and do a bit of boxing and things like that. And then on the upper deck, you used to play, on the flight deck, you used to play deck hockey. But there was things to do. It kept you occupied, yeah, yeah.
And what's the periods of boredom on board? Did you think you got bored?
Some people did, but I don't get bored. Even as a young man, I don't think I got bored. No, I didn't. I always found something to occupy my mind and everything. I mean, I know everybody's different, but some people do get bored. I mean, I know a lot of people say to me, you live on your, I said, I don't get bored. I just, you know, just, there are lots of things you can do.
Yeah, it's very lucky to be like you.
It's the easiest thing in the world to sit in a chair and get in a runt.
What about the sort of idea of the ship's company? I mean, did you say you had a friend already who was on the Eagle?
No, I didn't know anybody on the Eagle when I joined. And I had one of my chums was killed actually when the ship went down. And that was a chap who was Bill Morey, and he was in the pay office when I first joined. And he and I became chums, but of course, and there were people that you knew that you were friendly with, but I didn't have any sort of, apart from Bill Morey, I didn't have any close chums.
I mean, I suppose it's like sort of a little any sort of institution, if you're when you're at school or anything like that,
yeah, that's right.
You work out what your place
yeah, you
is.
You do, that's right. Yeah, yeah, that's quite right. Yeah.
And is it a sort of, but there must be a sort of feeling about belonging to a ship that's brings in a sort of an emotional attachment.
Oh yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, when the ship went down, of course, there was. I mean, we were all only too glad that we'd survived, and afterwards, you know, we used to meet up, but then. The majority of the people, I suppose, on the Eagle were probably just joined for the war only, hostilities only. So that sort of at 1945-46, most of them went outside, and there were like myself. We stayed on in the Navy, and so. You then sort of got newer chums, new people who met on other ships and that thing.
It's a very different thing,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is, really.
Yeah, I can understand
and,
that.
And it wasn't until, I think, about 1980, see, when I retired from my job, about 1985 or 1986, I had left the Navy then. I left the Navy in 71, and I worked for a firm of chartered accountants in Portsmouth, and it was at the time where naval messes and naval charities were being audited by private firms instead of wasting officers' time to do the audits. And the firm that I was in was doing these, and so I was. And then when I retired from Grant Thornton, that was the name of the firm, they asked if there was anybody else that I knew that could take over my job, because it was a job that commercial accountants, they wouldn't touch it, but they wouldn't know much about it. And so there was a friend of mine who was retiring, and he took over from me. And it was in the local paper that I'd been relieved by, and of course the firm thought it was good PR. And as a result of that, when I was interviewed by the local news, they said, "Oh, you must have been in the Second World War." And I said, "Well, yes, I was." And they were doing... I don't know what it was they were doing in articles on aircraft carriers, and they said, "Well, I said, yes, I was on two carriers," and so they, and that was in there. And of course, when it was in the paper and it was in Navy News, some of the Eagle survivors who were civvies then or long before wrote and said, "Well, perhaps we all ought to get together." And so we started a little reunion then. Only made it unofficial, but I suppose the first one, there was about 140. But now we've got it the last time when we had it. We still do it, but we don't do it officially. And last time there was only about three of us down there. And really the thing about it is, Mary, if I lived up in Liverpool or Edinburgh, at the age of 90-odd, would I want to travel all the way down to Portsmouth just for... And I wouldn't. So the fact that I'm local and one or two of the others are local, we still pop down to the war memorial on the day nearest the day of the sinking and just lay a few flowers and have a little ceremony and that's it, and then go away for a couple of drinks afterwards.
No, I think that's really lovely that you do it, that you still do it. Mm. You know, people aren't forgotten. And I think it's interesting as well how these things take a long time to happen. I mean, it's that you didn't actually start doing it until 40 years later.
No, that's right. It's because I think that... I suppose, really, it's a different world we live in today. People like to do these things. It's all up in your face all the time. But in those days, it was... it was only afterwards. And I think you... I don't know whether I'm right here or wrong, but you think that... All right, chaps are in the Navy during the war, or in the Army for 4 or 5 years. They go through everything. They're only too glad when it's all over to get away. When they get to the age of 60 or 65, they think, wouldn't it be nice to meet old chums? And that's how it happens, I think. But in between that, they're only too glad to have, well, it's something of the past.